Tonight, I'm very pleased to introduce you to Brenda Marie Osby, our visiting poet in residence. Brenda Marie, a native New Orleanian, is a poet and essayist working in English and French, and is Poet Laureate Emerita of Louisiana. Her most recent book is The Career Spanning All Souls Essential Poems. She is the author of several previous volumes of poetry and has been a resident fellow of the McDowell Colony, the Kentucky Foundation for Women, the Virginia Center for the Creative Arts, the Millay Colony, the Camargo Foundation, the Dora Maar House, and the Bunting Institute of Radcliffe College, Harvard University. She has received fellowships and awards from the National Endowment for the Arts, the Louisiana Division of the Arts, and the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Foundation, and she is the 2014 recipient of the Langston Hughes Award. Since 2011, she's been distinguished visiting professor of Africana Studies at Brown University. But we're most proud to say that before most of these accolades and achievements, Brenda Marie was a poetry fellow here in 1987 to 1988. And she's back as our distinguished writer in residence, a new program that resuscitates an old tradition of bringing established writers to work with and work among the fellows. Last year, Joy Williams was here as our inaugural writer in residence, and this year we're very happy to have Brenda Marie back among us. Her latest book, All Souls, is described as bringing together work that reflects the interweaving of history, memory, and the indelible bonds between the living and the dead. Please join me in welcoming Brenda Marie Osby.
Thank you, and good evening. I'm going to open with a poem called History, and it is the title poem of the book just before this. That book was called History and Other Poems. And so I'm reading a segment of the title poem. It's a long poem. I'm a narrative poet, but I'm not reading the whole thing. History. But I am tired today of history, its patinaed cliches of endless evil. That epigraph is from The Islands by Robert Hayden. And so we begin again our weary, wearied, and wearying lessons, because we have not learned them well enough. Only this time, without chanties about some ocean blue, because for us, all oceans are forever red. And we begin this time without the head and finger count for what's the real measure of human loss, once figures climb into the tens of thousands, multiplied by however many ships debarking from however many nations to archipelagos of death to continents of doom. And still for all that chatter, Goree persisting into the red and golden sun, its few hundred or so inhabitants making the daily ferry run, barely even eyeing the western born on across unroiling waters, and boys are playing at games, innocent as all of time. Time and even more time is what has dulled us so, for we are tired of lessons, and yet it is to lessons we must go. The looming sea is all about the wide, wide world, and it is wide, oh yes, it is. The world is wide and full of evil eyes. And the history of the world, if we would tell it, would strike us all down dead upon the spot marked with its greenish stain like money in the pokerman's upturned pot. Oh, and oh, and I am weary with it all. And here is yet another castle, another monument to look upon. And docents with their sad or singing eyes, the sharp, accentuated hush that follows as they speak, men fingering chains and such, and women who will not turn their eyes, and children who look about beneath the words that take so long to tell. The history of this world, which if we tell it straight, will kill us all before we even taste the smell of even the most rudimentary hate. On with it then. Then once and oh so long ago, we can only tell so much at any telling. We have lives such as they are, and other work to do, and can perhaps only stand the telling of this history in parts 1 and 2. In Bambara and Shango, Wolof and Pul, Shihiba, Tui, Ewondo, in Sara and Sarara, in Tupuri, Hausa, Mandara, Bulu, in Yoruba, Kinyarwanda, and Kikongo, and all the languages around the hardy Cape, then let us tongue and tongue as the aperture of the hardiest of the old line trumpeters, and this time let us try for once to get it right, and this time let us tongue it deep and well into the night. And bring me now the bones of Jogokao, and bring me the shroud of Pope Nicky V. Bring me the cape of old Victor Skelker, bring me the bastards, and let me have my way, and let it last until I've earned at last my full pay. The sun, bright disc cast against the sky that shines without warming ever, wasted gold set against blue skies that are not mine, nor ever will be. O São Tomé, O São Vicente, O Cape of all good hope, Elmina and Cape Coast, Ile de Gorée, Cabo de Delgado, Fort Ossou, all of them ages ago, last night when we were young. Shame, shame of Ghana. 36 of 42 built there as barter, Elmina grandest patroness of them all, wings of floors reconstructed into such grandeur. The women's quarters have a most unpleasant, most befouled odor, and thus the viewing balconies up above the sweltering human hum, fort and fortress. But never you mind about that, for there's enough to go around, and then 300 miles of coast, 60 known castles, remains of half as many undisturbed monuments to green and gold and silver god. Cape Coast, built by hardy Swedes, 16 and 53. Fort Ossou, 16 and 61, by the very captives who would stand and die there, rotting blood into the hard-packed earth. Lust for gold, lust for blackest black of gold, all so much whoring in the veins of a continent laid to waste, trading all along the coast, capturing and herding deep inside the hot interior. Oh, there be wealth enough for plenty and kingdom come before we bleeds them dry. Decreed that Greater Benin will export no more menace chattels, for to continue in that way should only weaken the core of our kingdom. Women and children remain free, however, to be enslaved at any time. See also Senegambia, Liberia, Kingdom of Congo, Sierra Leone, Gold Coast, Ivory Coast, Bight of Biafra, Bight of Benin, southeast of Africa from Good Hope to Delgado, and all of Madagascar. Why is it called Cape of Good Hope? Sugar, cotton, coffee, metals, tobacco, shipping, finance, insurance, industry, such cities as Amsterdam, Liverpool, Bristol, Stadenland, Whitehaven, La Rochelle, and Boston, Rotterdam, Newport, Nantes, Lisbon, such kingdoms as fill in the blank. And all along North Africa herself, Indian Ocean, and so-called Middle East, Sahara of shifting footprints. Why is it called, do you believe, Cape of Good Hope? And then, of course, that red, 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 red sea. Worlds, continents of exclusion, la trahison des clercs, the disironic unwillingness of colonial powers to self-destruct, mercantile, movable property, chattel, res, tyrannies of words thrown ad lib against the abject body. There is no history in this world that is not written in black. Obviously, that's about the transatlantic slave trade, which is the topic of that entire volume. Another time and morning south. I'm sorry, another time and farther south. for Clyde R. Taylor, A Morning Poem. In another time and farther south, I would give you ashes for your dead, clean white kerchiefs of linen or handwork silk, spread crushed shell before you, and tell you to kneel there and weep in dignity like a man. But these are times of strangeness. We are no kin. And this cold, dry air of your native Northeast cannot tend such an aesthetic as these gifts of mourning would require. So who am I to tell a man I barely know or love to kneel in the dust of pride and much remembering, weeping loudly for the death of a mother that no memory of pain can take away and no amount of sorrow can return? Can I say, death is one more burden, friend, and we bear it with us into even this driest earth? Can I tell you there is no time passing, no fondness in the eyes of friends that will return to you the life of the only woman to warm you in her belly and give to you the very life and air you live and breathe, the blood that warms you so much of what you think you know and have forgotten? No. These are words and stand for nothing more. But I can say that in another time, and so much farther south, I could have led you through the street in ashes, one of several women bearing you along to some sainted spirit ground you could believe on, a man who had lost his mother, still a son. And we, the cluster of women, could stand aside beneath the palms, pressing roots of ginger underfoot, watching you learn the lesson only death would ever teach. How you can lose so much in life and walk upon the earth a living man, wearing all the shrouds of mourning like a skin and memory like a stone inside your organs, alone for all the rituals of yielding, giving up, and still walk home, finding your way among strewn ashes in the dark. The book that I was working on when I was a fellow here at the Fine Arts Work Center was a book-length narrative poem in numbered and titled cantos. It's called Desperate Circumstance, Dangerous Woman. One woman, one circumstance. It's singular. At the center are two women, a woman named Marie Crying Eagle, and the spiritual mother in traditional religion in New Orleans, her spiritual mother, a woman named Regina. I'm going to read the section called Regina after I read Memory Number Two. Memory Number Two. The day we buried Mama hangs in my mind like a yellow cotton summer dress on the clothesline out back. What I remember? How her sisters, the two who outlived her, argued with me over everything. The plain wood coffin, her body, the clothes I chose to lay her out in, the ribbon of blue silk wrapped loosely about her folded hands, which held no meaning for them, the Mexican earrings hanging from her ears, the mass of gray hair I would not let the mortician dye or straighten, the nails shaped and painted that moony opal color she wore so often, and at the wake, the shameless way I touched her, holding, feeling, her hands and face, kissing her eyes and mouth as though she were a lover or alive. That night, you lay against me, your face pressed deep against the pit of my arm. I rubbed your smooth neck with one hand. You kissed my breast. I thought of Mama, the yellow cotton dress, blowing, hanging on the clothesline. Miss Regina stands above me, above my naked body, laid out on the pile of burlap filled with pungent roots, bruised herbs. She steps around me in her stocking feet, sprinkling scented waters about the burlap and my skin. Through the long window panes leading up from the floor, I can see the slates on the rooftops take on the faint light of a late sun going down. Miss Regina bends and puts both hands into the earthen vessel beside my head. She brings out the red cloth and puts it to my body, begins to rub slowly with a back and forth motion, my chest, my breasts, my sides, the soft of my belly, working her way along the stretch of my body, singing in the same sing-song voice she uses for everyday speech. I go back and forth between a hard, shaking chill and the calm of yellow cotton dresses. When Miss Regina leaves me, I am shaking almost to death. When I awake the next morning to the smell of thick coffee and biscuits heavy with butter, the shades are drawn. I lie in bed beneath blue cotton sheets and comforters. White towels and a wash basin await me, left in plain view, the way a woman Miss Regina's age would remember to place them. I wash. I peer into the looking glass, tilted back against the window ledge. When I let up the shade to see, there is Miss Regina in the backyard, hanging out the wash. Regina. If you walk along the rampart past where it breaks into St. Claude, one street back it takes up again. A little farther on is Frenchman, and Frenchman takes you nowhere, not to the river and not to the bayou. Frenchman is a place you go to. You do not walk along its length, going some other place. But that is another tale, and more than is wise for you to know. This end of the rampart, people like to tell how Regina went out to the backyard to hang the wash, and when she had strung her mother's bleached sheets from one end of the yard to the neighboring fence, one hand flew to her head, and she began to dance, stomp barefoot, there in her mother's backyard, for anyone looking to see. Some say she danced till noon. Some say she danced till dark. But they all say she danced. A young girl, dancing the spirit beneath the clothesline out back. No one knows what grief or burden she's paid or borne because of that. In this part of town, there is a tale for everything. When I was quite young, a child in New Orleans, my best girlfriend was a girl named Marceline. And I envied Marceline her sisters because I had a brother and she had two sisters, and I thought she could afford to give me at least one of them. This poem is called The Evening News, a letter to Nina Simone. A wail, a whoop, a line brought back from nowhere, deep violet of memory, stored up against hard times coming. We were righteous then, experienced in things we had not seen, but always knew would pass this way. We had righteousness on our side. They say you stood before a small audience in New Orleans last year and abused them for their smallness. Not just their numbers, but their looks. Their soulless way of sitting and waiting to be entertained. They told me how you stood there and cursed them good. Told me how they took it for the sake of all they used to be so long ago they never could forget. Could only say like the old folk, when cornered perhaps, said, "I disremember." I asked them what you wore. I remembered the years I struggled with the very private fear that I would remain a child forever and miss all that was major in our one moment of glory. Even a child knows there is one such moment, one. Even I had sense enough to see you and not weep. Even a child then understood the words sister, brother, people, power. And anyone could see we were all the evening news. And here you sing. At least that was what they called it. It was my best girlfriend's sister who came up on us, closed off in her bedroom, laughing over her cosmetics, her jewelry, her TV, her sex, and instead of sending us out, leaned there in the doorway and smiled, "You two know so much. Want to be so grown and everything. Need to quit all that giggling and learn to listen to Nina." That was late autumn. Aletha came into her own bedroom and sat between us on the bed. She turned up the volume but did not change the station. We watched her and her college friends in dashikis and afros on the evening news. That year, Marceline and I listened close to the lyrics and the ways, the easy breaths and breathless lines, the underground silences of you and Roberta. We argued and sassed, slapped hands on our hips at the slightest provocation, and learned when and when not to apologize for it. Two brown girls acting out, mothers looking out over our heads that way they had then, whenever we went so far we did not need to be told. We gave our telephone numbers to those boys with the hippest walks, the better grade of Afro, the deep changing voices, and we never took their calls. We danced the sophisticated sissy, the thing, the shake, the go-on, the soul strut. We counted our girlfriends, soul sister number one, soul sister number two. Marceline learned to cornrow, and I braided my older brother's bush each night. We were too much, and we knew it. We thought we understood it all. Deep violet. Deep violet. But that was years ago, and you were in your glory then. Then, while I was still younger than I knew or admitted and studying in South of France, I danced four nights out of five and all weekend, my arms on the hips or shoulders of some wiry brother from Cameroon or Ivory Coast, Senegal, Algeria, Panama, Martinique, one of only six or seven young black women at university, among the dozens and dozens of dark men who circled us, weaving their weightless cloth, their heavy guard, escorted when I would have been alone, fed when I had no hunger, driven when I lacked a destination, protected from the mere possibility of danger, and danger to them, we knew, meant Frenchmen, white men. Courted and cosseted and danced into sleeplessness, you will be old one day, sister, then you will sleep fine. But their hearts, the dark, wiry hearts of the brothers, were in the right places. The foolish ones said, you are like women of my country, and feigned weaknesses no one would believe they ever even remotely had known. And often enough had the immediate good sense to laugh at themselves and then at the rest of us. The others did something like waiting, danced, and at the end of an evening said, I have this sister, this Nina. Play some for my sister here, man. Man, get up and put on that Nina Simone. And we sat in the silence in the dark, as one found the shiny vinyl and put the needle to the darker groove. We sat choked with Roman cigarettes, too much dancing, too much good food. We sat listening and did not touch. We looked at one another's hands and read recognition there. One day we would be old. We would sleep and no longer know one another. We sat into the night until we grew hungry again and sick from the stale air. We listened. We wailed. We did not touch or bow down our heads. And that is the meaning of the word expatriate. If you live right, if you live right, if you live right, but what has living done for you? I heard your voice over the radio late one night at Cambridge, telling how you never meant to sing. Whoever interviewed you hardly said a word. He asked his questions, and you took your time. You breathed long breaths between phrases, your speaking voice lighter and less lived in than I remembered. You sang a line or two and talked about your life. I asked my question directly into the speaker. What the hell did living do for you, girl? I sat on the floor and drank my coffee. I paced the carpet between your pauses. I pulled my nightdress up in both hands and danced, but I got no satisfaction that night, and for what it matters, heaven did not come to me either. Don't talk to me about soul. Don't tell me about no damned soul. Years and years and years of all night long and a where are you and making time and doing right. Expatriate years, years, woman, years, where were you? And then you sang, fodder on my wings, with not a note of holy in your voice. And what could I do? A young woman, I put myself to bed. It was the following year that you cursed them down in New Orleans, dragged for them like muddy water. I listened to the story on the telephone, or looked into the faces I came on in the streets. What, I asked them, did she wear? And do you think they could tell me? All I asked the people was, what did the woman have on? And what about it? If your country's full of lies, if your man leaves you, if your lover dies, if you lose your ground and there is no higher ground, if your people leave you, if you got no people, if your pride is hurting, if you got no pride, no soul, if you're living in danger, if you're living in Mississippi, Baltimore, Detroit, if you walk right, talk right, pray right, if you don't bow down, if you're hungry, if you're old, if you just don't know, please, please, outside of you, there is no place to go. These are the expatriate years. These. The people drag their sorry asses out to see you, and you cursed them. You looked out into their faces, those you could see, and accused them. You called them down for all those years. You sang the songs you sang when you were younger, and you made them pay. And then, deep violet, and another time, no one will speak of. Dear Nina, I want to say to you how we did not mean it. How we did not mean to give you up, to let you go off alone that way. I want to say how we were a younger people, all of us, but none of it is true. We used you. And we tossed what we could not use to the whites, and they were glad to get it. We tossed you out into such danger and closed our eyes and ears to what was to become of you in those years, deep, deep violet. And worst of all, we did not even say your name. We ate you like good hot bread, fresh from the table of an older woman. And then we tossed the rest out for the scavengers. Does it matter? Does it matter when and how we did it to you? Does it matter we got no righteousness from it, that we felt no shame? Does it matter we took all good things in excess then and then again, not only you, but all things? Does it matter we sometimes return to you now, in the back rooms of childhood friends, forgiven lovers? Does it matter this is no gift or tribute or right or holy thing, but just a kind of telling, a chronicle to play back, against those images that never quite made it to the evening news? How cursed, how sorry a mess of people can we be, Nina, when outside of you, there is no place to go. I have a lifelong fascination with trains. And so this poem is called Speaking of Trains. I'll preface it briefly by saying it's dedicated to a friend, Moses Nkondo, who was a South African scholar of African-American literature, and he was doing a major work on African-American blues poetry. And he talked about this essay and read me snatches of it. And during one of our many conversations, it came up that he had never actually listened to blues music. And so this is my poem for my friend, whom I gave a homework assignment. He had to come to my apartment. We lived in the same house on Radcliffe Yard. He had to come to my apartment every morning, not speak to me, drink his coffee, eat his breakfast, and listen to blues, and then go home. Speaking of trains, from Moses Nkondo. South Train Study Movement 1. In the early morning hours, when the building makes what few sounds it has rehearsed during my brief sleep or absence, I move about as little and as cautiously as possible among strewn books and record jackets. Lyrics that tell of train whistles, of men standing alone in vacant lots, men in the process of leaving Cleveland, St. Louis, D.C., trains heading south into the night, trains that never return. I toy with phrases like cultural memory, canonization of despair. I invoke rituals of loss and forgetting. I do not sing. I make this other sound that catches the tissue of my throat like a bit of fishbone. It dries there and returns in chorus with some country harmonica or bass guitar, a piano touched by rude, eloquent hands. And I feel at the pit of my belly the most critical essay of my career. This year, I interrogate the blues. Going down to the river, gonna take my own easy chair, and if the blues don't get me, I'm gonna rock on away from here. That's why. Infra blue, ritual study and struggle. I interrogate the blues for something like fullness of meaning. But there are codes here, dark men and darker women, and I feel in my own hands the immeasurable buoyancy of am I blue? Am I blue? Went down to the railroad, laid my head down on that track, got to thinking about my woman, snatched my devilish head back, I want to know how long. In a New York barbershop head shop, the older brothers talk trash, incorporate me into rituals of loss and suffocation, desire and claim checks and umbrella stands, razor cut, trim and shave, pomade, what was her name? Man, I never did know, but she only ever wore blue. Hell, I just called her baby. St. Louis, Chicago, D.C., and the men stand vacant in their lots, in the process of memorizing, canonizing some moment, in the dark, baby, you and me in the dark. Like any other sensible man, I carry home that image like I carry home my haircut, incognito. Absolutely prepared to promise things I cannot possibly give if I can know her name, if I can know how she got away that way in the dark. I interrogate my senses for the dark woman coated in blue. Like any sensible man, I work my way through traffic to the station. She does not arrive. Evening trains never do arrive. I change my mind. Forget this city. Which of these women could ever remember? Which of these women could be movement in blue? It is evening. I have my fishbone and my hands on my belly. I have my essay and my evening meal. I move about as little as possible, the older brothers and their infra blue. Railway stations south to cities I will never see. I have my ritual study and struggle in the dark. I have my dark code painted onto the backs of my hands. I practice how I will say. Some questions have more rhythm than others. Repeat, repeat, off stage, interwoman in blue. Movement 2, how to meet the train. I have a method for meeting the train no one has scooped. I go with empty hands. I go with my beard just barely unkempt. I stand apart from the wall, never lean. I do not smoke or drink or eat the salted nuts. I have a method for meeting the train no one has scooped. Missing trains all my life at one station or another, I have become a man who understands the cries of whistles, the process of waiting. Going to meet the train, I wear my city eyes, turn up my collar, uncautious, still not reckless, distant, but not yet incognito. You think you recognize me, but oh, the many ways I could tell you you are wrong. Incognito woman in blue. The streets are empty tonight. I walk alone along this evening street, carrying nothing. I have business in this street. I will divulge to no one. I have some place in your dead remembrances, and I will not set you free. You may not touch me, or speak to me, or discover my name. I have these gifts for you. You must accept them without ever discerning what they might be. It is a hard business we bargain in here tonight, and there is strange conjure afoot, brother. Incognito woman in blue walks past every known landmark, past every familiar thing by which I might know her. She does not stop or change pace. She does not look back. She walks as if she had no hips nor anything between them, as if she had no concept of mercy. In the distance, inside some one of these houses, someone is trying to sing like Sarah Vaughan. It is not raining. These might be any streets. We might find ourselves in any of a dozen lonely, yellow-lit cities. We might be kin or lovers or any other sorry strangers in any foolish, terrible time. And around us, the night, the dark, and the hungry yellow streetlights. Watch your step, brother. Remember, I know who you are. Watch your step. Negro men in every time. Negro men better and wiser and lovelier than you have been known to lose life and the dream of life in safer streets than these. And just ahead is the station. There are two more poems. Litany of Our Lady. Our Lady of the sidewalks, the pavements and the crumbling brick, the mortar, rock, and oyster shell roads. Our Lady of sorrows and sadnesses, of intolerable agonies tolerated daily, of drifters, grifters, scrappers, and scrapers. Our Lady of dudes and dicks and pricks, of petty thieves and of whoremongers, of piss-swelled gutters and dives, and the grimed-over windows knotty-haired children peer through. Our Lady. Our Lady of boys shot down in the dark, dying in open lots along lesser-used roads leading out of town, of old men beneath interstates, sitting, standing, walking a block or so away and back. Our Lady of lost and found and forgotten, cast off, ditched, of what was and never will be again, of aggrieved and bereft, accused, indicted, surrendered up to death, of old tar-colored women in plain or checkered house dresses, telling aloud their rosaries and rosaries and rosaries of faith. Our Lady of ladies, and of church ladies in waiting, of young girls with hard, uncertain breasts, and promises of school and school and more school even than that. Our Lady of go-cups and fictionary tours, cigar bars, absinthe bars, of coffee houses open all night and churches closed all day, for admittance please ring bell and wait and wait and wait some more. Our Lady of antiques dealers dealing in saints, in crosses, weeping cemetery angels, prayer cards, in praline mammies, cigar shop Indians, in dwarf nigger jockeys whose heads have been lopped off, and stand, one hand outstretched, one cocked at the hip, seeming not to be waiting, but bargaining, dealing for the return of their heads, their perfectly round, perfectly lovely little nappy, nappy heads. Our Lady of tired buildings listing to one side, and brick between cypress posts that simply will stand, as houses themselves give way around falling downstairs, leaving only a something, a memory of a structure, of Spanish-tiled roofs and battened shutters, in a swamp of a city, of ironworks and of plaster. Oh, Lady, Lady, Our Lady of anything at all. The closing poem to the volume is kind of an old favorite of mine. It's called The Wastrel Woman Poem. She goes out in the night again, wastreling about. Her thin woman blues slung over one shoulder, an empty satchel one carries out of habit. The first time you see her, you think her body opens some new forbidden zone. You think she has something to do with you. She never does. At least, not the way you mean. Not here. Not anymore. Lives ago, perhaps, she would have been your second cousin, a woman who murdered you, a lover who passed you on market day, threw bones to the ground, or stepped over you as though you were dust or air, some spirit she knew of but did not counsel. The first time you see her, a story begins that has nothing to do with you, a woman Uncle Feather knew and never told you of. You were so young, and one day he lost the connection between your question and her name. Her name could have been anything, but you never would know. She would pass and look into your eyes directly as if you were not there, as if she knew it and would not tell. Takomela, takomela. Something you hear when she passes, sounds from another living. But there she is, wastreling about you. Someone calls to you. You watch your thin woman move between baskets of fish and date wine bottles. You turn to answer, heart like a brick, down between your knees. Thank you. New Orleans.
And how long did you stay there?
I live there.
You went back?
No, I live there. I've lived a few other places, yeah. West Coast, East Coast, France, a few places, yeah. Well, I've never lived any place else. I considered all those other places visits, even when they lasted 2 or 3 or 4 years. But I've always considered New Orleans the place I actually live. No matter where I am, I live in New Orleans. Yeah.
How did you feel about the time you spent in Palestine? Because that's the way I feel about
it. That's a wonderful question, because Provincetown now, I'm recovering from culture shock because the Fine Arts Work Center when I was here was pretty much bare bones. And of course I've seen the images on the internet, and I said, oh my goodness, this is like House Beautiful or something. But to be here in person and see it is really quite amazing to me. It's amazing. It's stunningly beautiful. My time here was wonderful. I got a lot of new work done. My second book had just been accepted for publication. I was working on the third, and bits and pieces of it had been published right at the moment I got here. So I was working quite furiously at that time. And it was a good year. It was a good year. I loved the silence. It seems to me there's been a major population boom in Provincetown, that there's maybe 20 times as many people here as there were when I was back in then. It was wonderful. It was absolutely wonderful. It was a really good year, and it was right before I decided to go back to teaching. So it was a transition, and now I'm back here again. So it's another kind of transition. I do. In fact, I'm working on a project with them now. We have two art schools in New Orleans that are both public schools: the New Orleans Center for the Creative Arts and Lusher. And I think of those as sort of my kids, my schools. And I work with them on a fairly regular basis. And in fact, when I get back to New Orleans after leaving here, I'm working on a fairly extended collaboration with some of the students there. And I'm very proud of the fact that year before last, the entire school did projects, art projects based around my book that was just published then, History and Other Poems. And people did plays, they did opera, they did dance, they did poetry, and the cuisine arts students did food. And we got to eat it afterwards. So I'm very fond of both Noka and Lesher. About
most
of my work is based in research, usually archival research. I love old dusty musty documents and the places that house them. And the poem, the title poem, History, for instance, is a really long, long poem, much longer than you think it is. Much of the research for that poem took place just before I went to France in 2004 for a residency, and during the time there, and then the poem itself came together after that period. the a poem that I did not read tonight that is entirely based in archival research is called The Head of Luis Congo Speaks. And Luis Congo was a free African man who lived in New Orleans and who had a job as the keeper of the High or Bayou Road. That was his official title. He was, in fact, the capturer and torturer of enslaved people attempting to escape by means of the High or Bayou Road. And so I did my original research for that poem in the archives in New Orleans. We're fortunate. We have about a half dozen different archival collections in the city of New Orleans. And then while I was on an accidental trip to... Biloxi. I've forgotten again. I can't remember it right now. But while I was on a trip there... Oh, no, I'm right. It is Biloxi. I sort of fell into the archival collection there and did the bulk, really, of my research. It was there at Biloxi that I found Luis Congo's price list for the varieties of tortures and deaths he was willing to perform in service of the government. So I'm fascinated by history itself, but also by historical documents, items, objects, maps, clothing, photographs, all kinds of stuff. So it's really how I spend most of my time.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't, not yet. I plan to go this year or next year. Yeah. I'm invited to go in November. I hope I make it.
Where?
Where am I supposed to go? Sierra Leone. I hunt them. I hunt them like a hunter hunts his prey. I grew up in New Orleans, which is a city that is infested with history. Every single individual, you know, has a kind of a history bug that we all carry around with us. And, I grew up in an arts family and a library family and a professorial family and sort of, you know. And so I've just always had this fascination. I was also fortunate in that I have an older brother. He's about 5 years my senior, who was the person who really introduced me to historical research and to the study of maps and so forth. And so I owe a great deal to my brother Lawrence. So, yeah.
There also seems another person with whom you are having discourse in the poem, the man studying the blues, or the spirit figure of Regina.
Mm-hmm.
Is there some question or interest in this question of discourse or exchange?
Yes. I think that most of my poems, even when I was doing short lyric poems, they were really narrative poems. I'm interested in story. I'm not so much interested in story itself. I'm interested in what I see as the human impulse to narrative, that as human beings we need narrative, and in the absence of narrative we create narrative, in the absence of dialogue we create dialogue even within ourselves. So that, excuse me, I often have a single speaker speaking in multiple voices, multiple layers of language, and I'll often, if the story itself is central to the poem, there are often multiple speakers telling alternate versions of the same story. But I think that narrative is a basic part of our, perhaps even of our function as human beings. I don't think that it's necessary that the narrative satisfy us in any way. Sometimes the narrative is useful because it frightens us or disrupts us or turns us even against ourselves. It's the act of making the narrative and the act of making the narrative that carries almost as much, and in some cases much more, than the nature of the tale being told. Oh, please.
So, follow that. So when did the narrative first become available to you?
To me?
You were first aware of that very thing you just described. How old were you? Or were you?
I like you. I like you. Can I take you home? I think the narrative has always been there because New Orleans is a tale-telling, lie-telling kind of place. And I grew up, and when we mean that in a positive way, when we say, you know, so-and-so is a great, like we always say the old jazz musician Danny Barker was a great liar because he told these wonderful stories about his upbringing as a jazz musician. So it's part of the stuff that we're made of. Much of it has to do with growing up in an arts family. My grandfather sang opera. My twin baby aunt sang opera with a local company called the Old New Orleans Negro Opera Company. My grandmother, however, was the family storyteller. And my grandmother was such a wonderful storyteller that my father, now this is my maternal grandmother, but my father preferred his mother-in-law's version of his family history to his own family's version. So narrative and tale-telling and all of those things are part and parcel, I think, of who we are. Also, I think music has a great deal to do with it. And I like to tell people that I was born listening to Sarah Vaughan, that I know Sarah Vaughan from the back of my mother's womb because my mother listened. My mother, who also had a beautiful singing voice but didn't sing professionally, unlike her sisters, my mother had a beautiful singing voice. And many of my best memories of my mother, who has since passed, are of her singing in the house. But my mother played Sarah Vaughan back to back to back to back to back while she was carrying me. And so I kind of feel like I came into this world knowing those songs with lines like, ages ago, last night when we were young. So it's always been there, and it's just part of the muscle and gristle and grit and the nitty of the plays. And there was another question somewhere around.
I was going to actually ask you about when you conduct research and you're looking for like archival ephemera, like records and archives, etc. I feel like in your poetry, I hear obviously a shift in content, volume, tone between the types of speakers. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering when you're conducting research, if you feel that kind of switch in the sense of being a witness or a listener to other kinds of narrative. I'm specifically thinking of first person narrative historically versus other maybe potentially more objective.
Yeah, supposedly capital H history. Yeah. Yeah. Yes, of course. And I do like that kind of first person material. Journals, diaries, letters, and so forth, but also simple objects. Keep in mind, this is New Orleans, and people tend to keep everything. So, you know, people have, for instance, most of the children of families I grew up with have things like the documents attesting to their family's freedom. And so forth. New Orleans has as many archival collections as it does because during the Civil War it was declared to be an open city, which meant that unlike Atlanta, which was burned to the ground and the courthouses and documents destroyed, New Orleans was determined to be a city of cultural and historical value, and therefore those structures were not burned. So we have documents going back to the earliest human presence in the place because we have
a few dozen native populations in the city, and there are interviews that the Jesuit explorers conducted, and there are grammars of a variety of Louisiana Native American languages and so forth. So when I'm talking about documents, those are some of the kinds of things I'm talking about. There are religious documents. Everything pretty much was documented under the French, and particularly under the Spaniards. And so there's just this plethora of materials there. I was employed once at the city archives and was there able to indulge my lust for materials. So the voices often come from the page, but the voices also come, like most things in New Orleans, I think, from the streets. In New Orleans, we say that culture sort of bubbles up from the pavement and whatever is below there. And so that's a long, in New Orleans we say going to the market to get to the square. So that's a long roundabout way of saying that I'm a really great eavesdropper. So if you don't want something to end up on a page somewhere, then you need to be careful about what you say to me. Because people say the most wonderful things just in the ordinary course of a day, or you're able to capture a quality of voice, a means of expression, a certain heft of language just by listening, which I think is really extremely important. Mm-hmm.
So, I love you. And when I was there, I was just aware of snow. But also, when I walked into a bar and said, that's food. It also had the chains slaves. So it freaked me out. But it also made me think about that. I want to ask you, do you believe in narrative dice? Do you believe in death?
Do I believe in death?
Yes. Or do you subscribe to death?
Well, in New Orleans, we actually celebrate death. You know, we invented the jazz funeral. Actually, we really didn't. We borrowed it from the Congo, but that's another story. But yeah, death is I think probably the centerpiece of New Orleans culture. One of the things that people do, regardless of age, is think about how they want to die and talk about it routinely. It was a custom many years ago for people to buy the casket they wanted because they didn't trust their family to get the casket they asked for. So many people used to buy their casket and keep it in the home in a visible place. And of course, you know, you want to use it for something. You don't want it just, you know, sitting there looking at you. And so many people used it as a place to store wine and other alcoholic beverages. So we have the reminders of death around us all the time. And, you know, our cemeteries are above ground because the land is so swampy. I mean, those aren't like monuments. They're actually in there. We live in there. And so we call our cemeteries cities of the dead. And we, in traditional religion in New Orleans, we say that at the stroke of midnight, the living and the dead shake hands. We also say that if you want to see your dead, hold a candle to your mirror. So the dead are continually with us. We speak with the dead, we walk with the dead, we talk with the dead. And I mean literally, I'm not speaking in metaphor now. My grandmother, every single day of my childhood, woke up in the morning speaking to my grandfather who was dead. She often went to bed that same way. If she was trying to decide something, she spoke to him. And to us, it was the most normal thing in the world. It wasn't until a friend of mine from someplace away with a capital A was visiting our home when I was in junior high school, I believe, and she said to me, "What's the matter with your grandma?" And I said, "Nothing's the matter with her. Why?" I thought she meant because she was singing while she was washing the dishes, because she couldn't sing. She wasn't a singing member of the family. I mean, she really couldn't sing. My grandfather, the opera singer, said that proof of the extent to which he loved his wife was that she could not carry a tune in a bucket with two strong Negroes helping her. Okay, so I thought she meant because my grandmother was so off key. She meant because she was talking to somebody who wasn't there. But of course, for us, he was there. I mean, I actually grew up thinking I knew my grandfather, who had already, well, he died when I was about not quite 2 years old. But all my life, I thought I knew my grandfather. I had these memories and so forth that people swore I couldn't have. So death is really central. And in fact, one of the things that happens is, you know, everybody has difficult family members, you know, and you don't want to wish ill on anybody. But one of the things that people frequently say, only partly in jest, is, well, you know, why doesn't Uncle Roger just die so that we can love him the way we want to? So that's death in New Orleans. And by the way, if you were in New Orleans and you loved New Orleans, then New Orleans loved you right back, I'm sure. Yes.
Is Katrina, has that changed the collective narrative at all, or is it, what kind of a bump?
Yeah, it was a big bump. it was cataclysmic. It was a flood of biblical proportion, and yet I've been quoted as saying, and I'll quote myself now as saying, it was a major thing. It was huge, but it was no bigger than we are as a people, and that. New Orleanians are resilient people, and so while there's still a great deal of work to be done 10 years later, for the most part, that work, when it's being done by us ourselves, is ongoing. There is still, you know, it isn't news, because people helping people isn't really good news. Nobody wants to hear about that. But there are still groups of people coming from arts organizations, from churches, from schools, from universities, and just ordinary individuals attached to no group who still routinely visit New Orleans to help with rebuilding efforts. So it's an ongoing rebuilding. But that also is part of the nature of the place. New Orleans thrives on improvisation. It's built into our DNA, I believe. And things are always changing. It's interesting to look at New Orleans as part of a certain kind of historical past. But those of us who are in the place and of the place know that those changes are always coming, and that it isn't so much the place that adapts as we adapt to the place. The place makes us, we don't make the place. You were going to?
Something? Oh, my question was in your research, mm-hmm. Are there men in New Orleans mm-hmm. that had a description of what the climate is like? And I wonder a lot about these records mm-hmm. that they're still preserved.
Oh, yeah.
Because I'm seeing them, like, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, one of the things that's interesting is that the City Archives is located in the New Orleans Public Library main branch, which is in the heart of the downtown Central Business District. It's the third floor of that building. They're finally working on that building. I'm so happy. It's on the third floor. It's called the Louisiana Division, and the City Archives is held within the Louisiana Division. But it also takes up two basements below the first floor. Now, you say basements, underground basements, because we have lots of above-ground basements in New Orleans. But underground basements. But when this structure was built, it was built to withstand flooding. And so all of those documents, two stories down, are perfectly intact. Also, of course, most of these materials have been microfilmed, microfiched, and are now, you know, available on disk and so forth and all of that. So, and the other thing is that I always like, having worked in an archives as an employee, I always like handling the actual document, you know. And so I always ask if I can see the actual document, and people are more than happy to allow you to see and handle the document. You know, you put on your little white gloves, and you have to have a pencil only and a certain kind of paper. And so forth, but it's worth it. It's worth it.
You obviously have a connection to Nina Simone, and your voice is so lyrical. There's music in your head, there's music in your voice.
Thank you. Thank you. That poem was written a long time ago. In fact, that poem was written right before I came to Provincetown. So it was written around. It was written when I was a Bunting Fellow, so that was 84, 85, or 85, 86, something like that. So it's really quite old.
What is your relationship to this
city? Well, right now my relationship is that I'm hoping and praying that it does not flood the city of New Orleans. There is some danger of that. It's a small danger. All of the warnings that we're getting now are sort of preemptive. They've been warning for more than a week in advance. They're thinking that it will crest for us on Tuesday because we're the bottom. We're the very bottom of the Mississippi River. And because it is a huge and powerful river. The name, by the way, Mississippi, comes from the Native American word Mesachabe, which means father of waters. And so it is a powerful river. We're the Crescent City because we're in the crescent of the river. And so such things as north, south, east, and west have absolutely no meaning for us. We just slap north on something, slap south on something because it sounds cute. Has nothing to do with the direction of anything. For instance, everything that's a south street in New Orleans, like South Pier, is uptown, which sounds backwards, I know. And everything that's north is downtown. We talk about lakeside and riverside. That's how we describe space in New Orleans. So the river is pretty much everything. It's really rare also for us that the river should flood. Keep in mind that the flooding that we experienced in 2005 was Lake Pontchartrain. And so those areas nearest the Mississippi River are the highest elevation and are generally protected from flooding. So the closer you are to the Mississippi River, the safer you are, actually. It sounds kind of crazy, but it's true. That's the highest ground in the city. And so should the Mississippi River flood, it would be, at our location anyway, it would be rare. It would be a truly rare event. And it would be one of the first times that that a space like the French Quarter or the Faubourg Tremé would actually suffer major flooding. Yeah, street flooding. We get normal street flooding. What counts as a hurricane in places like Virginia and even in this region, the Northeast, is for us kind of a bad thunderstorm. And there are, you know, we have people who have a devotion to Saint Médard. And Saint Médard was a teenaged boy who is the patron saint of farmers and patron saint against flooding and so forth. In New Orleans, we have a different twist on it. And we say that if it rains, everybody everywhere who has a devotion to Saint Médard says that if it rains on whatever his day is, that means that there'll be 40 days and 40 nights of raining. We say that what happened was Saint Médard wept for the sins of the people on that day, and that's why it rains on that day. And if it chances to rain on that day, then it will indeed rain 40 days and 40 nights. And I've seen it a few times in my life that it did rain 40 days and 40 nights in the city. So the river is its livelihood for many, many people, and it's really what defines us. The reason that the city was built where it was built is because of the Mississippi River, which is a major trade route, and the pathway to South America as well. Yeah, so because it lets out into the Gulf of Mexico. So yeah. Thank you so much.